So we always start out, at least I do, with some sort of mindfulness practice just to settle down and get the mind settled down. And then we can segue in this in a sort of an analytical or contemplative type meditation. But let's start out with sitting up straight. If you're on your cushion or chair, you want your backs, straight. And in a perfect world, your shoulders would be a little bit back and down. Your chin just slightly tucked in, the tongue at the roof of the mouth, the feet are on the floor, or you know, half lotus, full lotus, whatever you can handle. And usually we do, there's lots of different ways to do the hands, depending on the practices. Some people will put their thumbs on their ring finger and make a fist, and that goes on the like this. Usually what we do is it's very interesting in Zen Buddhism, because I've been to Japan and done this. And then you have the right hand down and the left hand on top of the right hand, and then the thumbs touch right at the level of the navel. In Tibetan version, left hand down, right on top, thumbs touching. Again, the thumbs are at the level of the navel. And that becomes more important. And we're not even close to this, but in high sugar tantric practice, sometimes you need to be able to focus your mind at the level of the navel. So this having your thumbs touch there helps to bring the mind there. So in any case, let's start out with three sort of deep cleansing breaths. And as you inhale, imagine your abdomen just expanding. And then as you exhale, letting go of all the stuff of the day. We'll start out that way and then settle down and just follow the breath. You're going to just monitor the breath wherever it's most noticeable to you. And it actually doesn't have to be the breath. It could be so many different things. It has to be one thing. You pick one object, meditation. I had a teacher in Thailand, actually, and he had is what we call tinnitus, or some people call it tinnitus, like ringing in his ears. And he called it the ringing silence. And that was what he focused on in his meditation practice. Many people will focus on the breath, the sensation at the tip of the nose, rising and falling of the abdomen, the chest. Some people prefer sounds. You can meditate on the sound or just the sensation, like the body sitting, the sensation of the feet in the chair, or the hands in the lap. So there's many different objects that are suitable for this type of practice where you're practicing mindfulness, because it is the nature of the mind to be distracted. Bring it back again and again to whatever your chosen object is. And when the mind wanders, which is the nature of the mind, is to ruminate and not stay focused. We haven't trained our mind. We weren't raised in a culture where concentration was even considered to be necessarily a great thing unless you're studying for a test or something. But just in day-to-day life, so important to bring the mind back again and again to the focal point. And again, when the mind wanders, you think, well, this is what the mind does. This is just how it rolls. It just constantly looking for things that are delicious or interesting or provocative and wants to follow those versus just sitting in this boring meditation position, just focusing on the breath. But it's so important to be able to choose a neutral object and to keep the mind focused on that. And the quality of mindfulness, that's a word that gets thrown around a lot. I even saw a book called Kindfulness. I kind of liked that one. It was a magazine. But mindfulness, there are different definitions for it. Lots of different people seem to have a different point of view, like being present in the moment or being focused, being aware. In the teachings on the 51 minds and mental factors, when they look under mindfulness, the definition is recollection, which is an aspect of mindfulness. And actually, it's really important that we recollect the teachings, that we recollect our vows. We notice what's happening, and we notice if it's causing suffering or happiness, and we use that quality of mindfulness, i.e. recollection, to help guide our behaviors, because things that cause us suffering, we need to stop doing. Things that lead to happiness, we need more of. One of the key, let's go ahead and do the prayers now. Have you got those? So we're going to do refuge in bodhicitta. Let's see, yeah. All right. Where is the camera? Over there? Okay. All right. So, again, I like to explain to people what we're doing. Just every time, I know because they're new people, and this is all seems very, if you're, we used, back in the early days of Godobson, we had a lot of former Catholics. I don't know how about now, but a lot of people don't like prayers and rituals and things like that. But they, when they're understood and they're done mindfully, they can be extremely helpful to our practice of meditation. As I said last time, Lama Yeshe said that since the key factor in karma is intention, and we're going to practice meditation with the intention of finding you know, peace and happiness and actually full enlightenment eventually. The key factor is intention. And if we spend 58 minutes of a 1 hour meditation setting intention and two minutes meditating, that's better than 58 minutes of meditating and 2 minutes of like helter skelter motivation. So here we are. So we go on. First two lines is difference between a Buddhist and a non-Buddhist. So we'll do that and then we'll stop. And here's what you do too. Before you do these prayers, you always want to think three things. Number one is confidence. And maybe you don't have confidence. Maybe this is going to take time. Maybe it's going to, you're going to have to put these practice into teaching, these teachings into practice for years, or meet really some incredible holy beings that inspire you. There's so many things that can give you confidence in the Buddhas, enlightened beings, and your potential to be enlightened, Dharma, or the realizations of the teachings, and your own potential to realize the teachings, and the Sangha, or the spiritual community, and your ability to become that for other people, a helper. So this separates Buddhism from non-Buddhism. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. That's the Sangha. Now, the second two lines are separating, actually, it's distinguishing us as practicing the Mahayana path, which has to do with bodhicitta, okay? By the merits that I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. All right, now usually we're talking about, you know, there's six perfecting practices and so forth. But here we're just talking about listening to the Dharma. Any seeds that can be planted, may we become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. And it really ought to be the other way around. I want to benefit all sentient beings. How can I do that? I must become a Buddha, like that. So we'll do it two more times, but this time we'll kind of go quickly. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Oh, the other two things that you want to think about when you go for refuge is not only confidence, but dread, which sounds kind of weird. Sometimes your word is fear, but it's dread. Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's dread of being reborn in the three lower realms. But since most of us don't even believe that there are three lower realms or don't have a strong faith in rebirth, you know, being afraid of that doesn't seem to get people out of bed in the morning. But I'll tell you what it will get me, it gets me motivated, is that I know what a mess my mind is. And if I don't get a handle on it, it's just going to create more and more suffering for me right up until the end of this life. And if there is a future lifetime, if I've done a lot of evil, bad things, then I am going to the joyless realms, which are the lower realms. I don't want any part of that. So confidence in the three jewels to guide us to, you know, out of our state of confusion is supreme happiness, and dread of the consequences of living our lives out with this mind that's wild you might be better than most people, but most people focus on themselves 90%, 95% of the day. Everything's about me, me, I. Not much good karma comes out of that. In fact, only negative karma comes from motivations motivated by self-interest. Only the actions motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance, only those actions actually plant seeds for happiness. So that's important. And then last but not least, the reason to go for refuge is compassion. Compassion for ourselves and compassion for all sentient beings, because we're going to train ourselves to become a Buddha. And that's going to be based on sincere compassion, which is main topic for tonight. All right. Do it again. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Sometimes good to have a visualized image of the Buddha like a hologram in front of you as you're saying these light and nectars coming in into your body and completely purifying your body, speech, and mind. Sometimes that's a good way to have good visualization to do. The four measurables. Now, the first one is basically the Buddhist definition of happiness, of love. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. The second one is the Buddhist definition of compassion. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. And that includes me and you. We're part of all sentient beings. So we're not saying that we shouldn't have compassion. We'd only have compassion for others. We should have compassion for ourselves as well. Third is, it has to do with what they call great love. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. That would be like nirvana. And then may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends or hatred for enemies. And equanimity is the main subject that we're going to talk about tonight. But notice, let's say it again. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for others. Now, here we're at where we're wishing this for all sentient beings, which includes us. But when we do the motivation in bodhicitta, we're really focusing on our own mind, on developing this equanimous state of mind, which is the foundation for developing bodhicitta. And the last one is the mandala offering, the short mandala offering. Again, this is traditionally done before the teachings, and it's imagining that you're offering up like everything that's wonderful in the universe to the teacher, you know, to the guru, asking him or her to grant you the teachings, and that the teachings are so valuable to you, you'd be willing to give up grounded, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, so everything beautiful, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun, the moon. That's the entire universe from a Buddhist cosmology perspective. Mount Meru's in the center, and there are four continents, the sun and moon. It's like everything in the universe. You'd be willing to give up everything just to get these teachings. I imagine this as a Buddha fill and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. And then Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryata Yami means send forth this jewel mandala to you precious gurus. So this is a good way to start out, you know, after you settle in mind to start a meditation session. Now, we're going to just, you can straighten up again, reach up over your head, and stretch, and then we're going to sit down for a few more minutes because Dr. Watkins has warned me I only have 1 hour. So I have to really, this is going to be hard because I tend to be talky. Anyway, we'll do what we do. He's not watching. So now let's settle back into meditation posture, and we're gonna do those 11 meditations that we talked about last week. I'm sure you all remember those, right? Anybody memorize them? Raise your hand if you memorize them. I want to see who's. You wrote them down. Hey, we got to. Thank you. That's a good start. But now you have to, we have to memorize it. Nobody graduates from this class without having memorized these 11 points. I'm telling you, there's no diplomas offered. You have to, this is, honestly, if you don't memorize, if you don't remember anything else in Buddhism, remember the Four Noble Truths, the Three Principles of the Path, and the 11 Meditations on How to Develop Bodhicitta. By the way, anybody know what the Four Noble Truths are? She's got them written down again. Here we go. We got them written down. All right. Four noble truths. I got to give you this because this is the basis of everything we do here. The four noble truths. This is the first thing the Buddha taught. And if you're going to develop compassion, to be sure, you need to know what these things are. The first noble truth has to do with dukkha. D-U-K-K-H-A. Dukkha. I love the Geshe Gelug. He's trying to spare us the harsh word called suffering, but it is suffering. It's dukkha, I think, maybe translates suffering. It's just anything you don't want, but it is also it's also inconvenient. It's also things that it's just dukkha in general. Includes everything that this living beings don't want. And we categorize this first teaching that the Buddha gave. He talked about the suffering of pain, which is everyday suffering, isn't it? It's no big deal. But it is a big deal because it pervades our consciousness. In fact, Lama Zopa said the worst suffering of all is this mind that's never satisfied. So we're not talking about cutting your arm off or being sick on a ventilator or, you know, some kind of, or even be morbidly depressed. It's just never, ever, ever being satisfied. We have that kind of mind. And he said it's because it's cumulative suffering over the course of a lifetime. It's like bigger than Mount Meru, bigger than Mount Everest. This huge amount of suffering that we endure because of dissatisfaction, never finding peace and satisfaction, which is what we want in our heart of hearts. So there's a suffering of pain, which includes everything that you can imagine, you know, sickness, old age, death, meeting leads to parting, high position leads to low position, all composite things must separate into their parts. We get born and born again and again. We have to die again and again. The number of corpses that we've taken, if we took all of our corpses and stacked them up on top of one another, Mount Everest would look like a molehill. We've died that many times. That's the kind of attitude we need to remember, that we've taken so many lifetimes, never, ever being satisfied. So that's the suffering of pain. The suffering of change is that everything we now enjoy, everything that is we now label as pleasure, cause of happiness. I have to be a little careful here. I don't want to sound too negative, but most everything that we enjoy, if we engage in it enough, it will become boring, and we won't want to have anything to do with it. So it changes into suffering. You can think about, you know, going on vacation. After about, you can take a 2-week vacation. That's in the middle of that second week, you're like, I can't wait to get home, you know, or you can talk about parties, you can put drugs, sex, and rocks and rock and roll. You plug in whatever you want, but you can't get enough of it. And sooner or later, it turns into suffering. It turns into exactly what we don't want. So, and we're all caught in this cycle of uncontrolled causation where we just have this stuff going on nonstop. It's chaos. I love the word chaos. And then the third kind of suffering is called pervasive suffering. And it's like, it's like having a big burn on your arm and, you know, the skin's raw and, you know, that you pull the blister off and it burns like the dickens. And somebody pours some cool water on it and it gives you some kind of a sense of soothing for a minute. You go, oh, that feels so good. You know, but then the pain comes back because the cool water dissipates and the pain comes back. And then you pour more cool water on it. This is pervasive suffering. This is how the Buddhists say it. The Buddhists say that the nature is the burn. And we have moments of temporary respite from suffering. And that we label happiness. But it doesn't last. It's always in a state of flux. So this first noble truth is dukkha. We always talk about, you know, classic ones are, you know, birth, sickness, aging, old age, and death. But it's whatever you can imagine. And then the second noble truth is the truth of cause of suffering. So the first thing is we're sick, right? We're sick. And we have to have enough compassion for ourselves to want to be free from suffering. We also have to have some belief or faith that it's even possible to be free from suffering. So that's the first noble truth. And it's like compassion for yourself. I want to be free from suffering, and so I'm going to do something about it. The second noble truth is the truth of the cause of suffering, which is karma and delusions. Every action of body, speech, and mind plants seeds in our continuum that will ripen in the future, suffering or happiness. Virtue, the way you know something is virtuous is the long-term consequence of the action is happiness. The way you know something is non-virtue, the long-term consequence is suffering. Now you might think, well, wait a minute, some person who's raping somebody might actually be experiencing pleasure in the moment they were doing that. So you might say, well, that was actually, if they were experiencing pleasure, then by this definition, you say, well, that had to be the ripening of positive karma. But raping is such a heavy negative karma that down the road, enormous suffering. So it's like, you know, everything is karma. Everything is caused by karma, motivated by our delusions. Our principal delusions are greed, hatred, ignorance, pride, and jealousy. But every one of them is undermined by egocentricity, right? We talked about how all the suffering from beginning of beginningless time until now is caused by the self-cherishing mind. That's the cause, the underlying root cause of our suffering. Third noble truth is, now this one's hard to buy because we don't have the confidence that we could stop our own suffering. But the third noble truth is the Buddha said you're sick, suffering. There's a cause of sickness, karma and delusion. The good news is it can be cured. The sickness can be cured by taking away the causes. So alleviating ignorance, which is the cause of greed, hatred, ignorance, pride, and jealousy, and all the negative karma that comes out of that, we can eliminate the ignorance, we achieve freedom. It's possible to achieve nirvana, complete freedom from suffering, and beyond that, even enlightenment. And then the fourth noble truth is the truth of the path. And it's important for us to talk about this because that's where bodhicitta comes in. Now, there's different ways that it's packaged. But the way, you know, there's the lower scope, the middle scope, and the higher scope beings. And we always talk about, a lot of times we talk about three principles of the path. And the first one being renunciation, which basically means we're renouncing suffering and its causes. We have this determination to be free. We want to get free of suffering. We got enough compassion for ourselves to do it, right? That's true compassion. Renunciation. The second one, the second of the three principles of the path is bodhicitta, which is this altruistic intention to become enlightened based on love and compassion. So the goal is to liberate sentient beings from whatever state of confusion and suffering they're in, the supreme, and guide them from whatever their state of confusion is, all the way to supreme enlightenment. That's our goal. Not easy, you know. It's like not even easy to even think about it. That's what bodhicitta is about, and the method to do that is to get enlightened ourselves. So what do we want to do? We want to guide beings from suffering to supreme happiness. How do we do it? We get ourselves enlightened. How do we get enlightened? We practice the three principles of the path. We practice renunciation, determination to be free, bodhicitta, which is this altruistic intention based on love and compassion to free all beings from suffering. It's an attitude totally antithetical to selfishness, totally antithetical to egocentricity, our biggest enemy. Now, that's why it's so powerful. And it's dedicated to infinite beings. So it's much more powerful than an action motivated just by self-interest, because it's motivated to countless beings. And then the third principle of the path is emptiness, wisdom, seeing things as they are. And it's said that a Buddha is somebody, when you get enlightened, what you're going to experience is not only joy and bliss beyond your wildest imagination, where you're going to know exactly what to say and do for every sentient being who you encounter to help them open their minds and find their own true happiness, their own path to liberation and Buddhahood. So that's called skillful means. Compassion, this great compassion that's for all beings, not just friends, but for strangers and enemies and the whole package, everybody. We have compassion for universal living beings. We have love for universal living beings and power. That's the other feature that a Buddha has. Skillful means, great compassion, great love, and then power, because you got to be powerful. You got to have resilience. You got to have tenacity to get through all of this and to be able to impact those lives. So those are the key points. And the middle of the three principles of the path, the first one was renunciation. Remember, again, you have to understand suffering before you want to be free from suffering. This is not even a joke, but it's kind of cute. How do you keep somebody in jail forever and ever? Never tell them that they're in jail. They'll never want to get out. They won't have any wish to get out. But it's only until we realize that we're in jail, and in a jail created by our own delusions, our own mind, until we realize that we have created this jail called our samsara, and that we have some confidence that we can be free, it's only then we develop renunciation. So that is compassion for ourselves. And then bodhicitta is what this class is about. And then emptiness is another class, which, you know, we talk about, we'll talk about in this class. Again, relative bodhicitta is what we're talking about now. I want to say supreme bodhicitta, but I guess that's the ultimate bodhicitta. Yeah, is emptiness. So tonight we want to talk about equanimity. That's going to be the main focus of tonight's discussion. But before we do it, let's open up to any questions. Looks like there's a few people out here, at least 16, and then a few here.
Yeah. So if there are, can y'all hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Does it sound?
Could be about anything, you know.
If you can hear me and you have a question on Zoom or YouTube, feel free to put that in the chat. If you are here in person, just raise your hand.
Mm-hmm.
Any questions? Oh, or if you're on Zoom, you can also raise your hand or just like indicate or unmute and ask a question. You don't have to type it in the chat.
All right. You didn't raise your hand. Aaron was doing like this. I thought it was a hand going up. All right. Well, let's see. Maybe I have a question. So why do you think equanimity is so important? I said this last week, but let's hear your version. Why is equanimity like the foundation? Anytime anybody says, let's motivate on universal compassion, why would equanimity be the first thing you do before you even start thinking about other suffering? Why would, again, universal compassion now, that means it doesn't exclude anybody. It's a little key, a little clue why meditation on equanimity is so important. Anybody? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. So it's thank you, and that's good. He said levels the playing field, and it's exactly right. If we want to develop compassion for universal living beings, that means not just humans, but it also means animals, and it means all sentient beings. Sentient beings is another way of saying beings that are capable of feeling. That's how when I looked up the word sentient. But I like the word living beings. I think that kind of says the same thing. It's a little bit more, pedestrian kind of conversation. But we need to have an equal feeling. Right now, we obviously feel close to our friends, right? But there's the strangers and then the so-called enemies, the people that we have aversion toward. And right now, if I was going to motivate for, bodhicitta to begin life, it would mainly be for my friends. It wouldn't be for the people I don't know or particularly the people I dislike. If somebody you dislike is suffering, by the way, doesn't make you automatically compassionate, does it? Just seeing suffering, does it? Hello? Curious. Anybody think just seeing suffering makes you feel compassion?
No.
Why? So the answer is we don't have any connection, but there's more to it than that. What kind of connection do you need to have to feel compassion? Pardon? We want them to be free from suffering, but that implies something else, doesn't it? It implies connection, but actually implies that there's a real affection, right? If you hate somebody, now during our last presidential campaign, and a lot of people, our former president was hated by a lot of people, but the current president's hated by a lot of people too, for that matter. You want to be hated? Become a president. That's probably guaranteed. So, you find people you don't like. When they suffer, you rejoice. If you don't feel close to them, suffering could actually make you rejoice. When Saddam Hussein, was shot or hung, or how he died, a lot of people rejoiced. But that's not necessarily the cause of suffering. We have to develop this sense of connectedness. Starts out with equanimity. Starts out with this feeling of equal regard for sentient beings. Now, there are two ways to develop it. See if I can remember.
Don, it looks like, Bob, do you have a question?
No.
Or a comment? Okay. I saw that you were unmuted, so I just thought maybe you wanted to chime in. Sorry to interrupt.
Well, this is, I've been reading this book on compassion by Jeffrey Hopkins, and he's, there's more ways to do it than this, and I'll go over some of them, but equanimity, I think, is, not only is it the foundation of the meditation of bodhicitta, but it's day in and day out, it is the most practical one for me after trying to do this for almost 40 years. This is the one meditation that I can do that helps me deal with a lot of difficult situations and people in general. But what we want is equal regard for all sentient beings. So Jeffrey said, one of those ways is to see that we're all equal. In wanting, I talked about this last time, the Dalai Lama, and Jeffrey translated for the Dalai Lama for the first 10 years, wanting happiness and avoid, I'm going to put down dukkha. Okay, dissatisfaction, suffering, whatever you want to call it. So we're all equal in wanting that. Everybody Every animal, every human being wants, in fact, you look at somebody's eyes and you know something about them that's incredibly intimate. You know exactly what makes them tick. Now, they might do a lot of weird things. I mean, they may do things that you don't agree with, but I can promise you it's motivated by one thing. They want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. And sometimes people will commit suicide, right? Because that looks better than dukkha. That looks better than life. That's how, you know, it is such a powerful attitude. We all want to be happy. We don't want to suffer. We'll do anything to find happiness and to avoid suffering. We're all exactly equal that way. And this is one of the meditations that we can do to develop equanimity. And you do it with real people. You start out with yourself, maybe, and then you work with your family. You don't do it with, because we could say, well, self is one and others is infinite. And all of a sudden it means nothing. So you work with your spouse, with your family members, with your children, with your coworkers in your meditation practice. You go, you know, wouldn't it be nice if she could have, you know, happiness and be free of suffering? Because I know that's what she wants. I know that's what he wants. Everybody wants it. We all want it. Then we go to the next person. May he have happiness and be free of suffering. And then until you get a feeling for that, not just say the words, but you start out with friends and then with people that, you know, maybe the faceless people in the crowd, somebody you see at checkout counter or something, maybe somebody you recognize, but you have no feeling for them, mainly indifference, and you wish for them. May you be happy. May you be free of suffering. The next time you're in front of them, you say that little mantra in your head. And then you gradually move over to the people you have more difficulty with. And then you can expand that to include like everybody in your community, everybody in the state, everybody in the country, everybody all the living beings on this planet. And then all the living beings throughout the universe, because most of us probably got a hunch, a hint that this ain't the only game, and this is not the only game in town, the Earth. The universe is big. There could be plenty of places where living beings could be. And so we want to, you know, we're imagining, you know, universal living beings. You know, we want to get enlightened for universal living beings. And they all want to be happy. They don't want to suffer, right? So this is one meditation that to develop equanimity that works. You have to practice it with real people, not, you know, well, I want to do it for everybody in Cary. But you start with your family. You start with real people, and you work through that. The other one is changeability. Changeability. I'm not sure if this is how you spell it, but anyway, changeability. So what does that mean? So how many people today had really good friends when they were growing up that they wouldn't even recognize now, probably, if they saw them? I guarantee you, I do. I've seen pictures of my classmates. I go, who are these people? I don't even recognize their names, much less their picture. You know? So things change. People that were friends can become strangers. And how many people in here have been divorced? Yeah, I mean, I have. I know a lot of people have been divorced, sometimes multiple times. And here's a situation where your best friend becomes, well, couldn't, you know, particularly if it's not amicable, which very few are, somebody who's like you would literally give your life for, all of a sudden they're over here in the category of, like, I don't even want to see him or her. Forget about it. You know, totally dislike, aversion. So that could change, couldn't it? Just a few misplaced words or one bad decision, one stupid little bad or big bad decision turns a friend into an enemy. By the way, a kind word or kind action can take a so-called enemy and turn him into a friend. And then where did our enemies and friends come from in the first place? They were all started out as strangers, weren't they? Eventually, they were all strangers in the beginning, but something happened. We said something that was nice or pleasant, and then this particular stranger became kind of a friend, and then more of a friend, and now they're a frenemy over here. You know, it's completely changeable. Relationships are not substantial. We put labels on people, friend and stranger. Friends we attach to, strangers we feel indifference toward, right? Pretty much. We see them, we don't feel, if they're having a hard time, we don't know because we're not going to ask. And we don't really care because we're more interested in ourselves. So we basically relate to strangers with indifference. Now, I'm not speaking to you people because probably this room is full of bodhisattvas and I'm the only ordinary deluded being, but I'll just go with that. Yeah, so strangers could go either way. And then enemies are, you know, again, changing. Everything's so changeable. These labels are not fixed. But as soon as we fix them, we get stuck. And now we can't function. We cannot develop compassion for somebody who is inherently my enemy. Now, here's a kind of a different way of analyzing it that I find helpful. It's kind of fun. This one is to take the so-called enemy, the person that we've labeled enemy. Bring to mind somebody right now that you would label somebody that you feel aversion toward, right? And let's think about it like that. I know, why do you feel aversion toward that person, toward that being? They probably said or did something to you or to one of your friends that offended you, that made you feel aversion, all right? So their actions that offended you, where did that come from? Where did that come from? If something comes into my world and I experience it, it's the fruition of what? My own former actions. Yeah, karma. So I plant karma. Actions motivated by greed, hatred, or ignorance, body, speech, and mind, plant karmic seeds that ripen in the form of, if I harm somebody, somebody's yelling and harming at me. If I want to be yelled at, all I have to do is yell at people. If I want to be physically harmed, I can physically harm people. The karma is absolute. It will come back. So everything that we're experiencing, all these challenging people, are the karmic fruit of our own former actions. So the real demon here is not that one out there, is it? What is it? What's the demon? Self-cherishing selfishness. It's our own ego that causes us to, you know, to kill and steal and commit adultery and lie and slander and harsh and frivolous talk and greed and hatred and ignorance. All the 10 virtuous actions, all motivated by self-cherishing selfishness. Always going to cause misery. Always going to cause problems for us. So, any comments, questions about this? Kind of on a roll, but I'll back off a little bit. Yeah, go ahead.
My understanding, one aspect of equanimity is actually detachment from people you really care about. Could you expound on that?
Yeah, it's what is the opposite of attachment? Is it detachment or non-attachment? It's not attachment. It's letting go. So what we're letting go of is the clinging. We're letting go of the clinging to the label friend and what that means. Because as soon as we cling to a label, we automatically overestimate its positive potential if it's a friend, say, for example. If it's an enemy, we overestimate their negative qualities. If it's a stranger, we overestimate their indifferent qualities, you know? So the opposite, so what we want to do is let go of the clinging, but still we want to have equal regard for all beings. So we understand they're just like I am. They want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. The Dalai Lama has said that 100,000 times. You know, every talk, if you ever go listen to him talk, every talk he ever starts out with, we're all the same. We all want to be happy. We don't want to suffer. We're all the same. He starts it out like that. Okay? And it's this letting go of the attachment to the friend is not detachment. It's non-attachment or letting go. Okay? Same thing with stranger. Same thing with enemy. It's letting go of the label and what it means to us and seeing everybody as like equal. Equality of self and others. It's a little bit hard concept. But love isn't, this is not love yet, is it? We're just getting to the point where we can relate equally to everybody. So now we just talked about how any harm that we experience is the fruition of what? Our own former actions. So any difficult person or situation that we see is our karmic projection. Where did it come from? It's not out there, independent of my mind. I'm creating it. The projector's right here. This is completely empty. It's literally a blank screen. My karmic projector, my own former actions, virtuous and non-virtuous, are projecting my reality, and I get to see what I've created. The seeds are ripening to bring it back to me. I mean, do we want to suffer? No. We don't want to. So actually, our enemy, here's another reason to like the enemy. Why are the enemies helpful? Because they point out our faults. They are so happy to point out areas where we need to work on. You know, they know all of our buttons. They like to push our buttons. And who teaches us patience? It's not our friends. It's not the strangers. It's the enemies, the people, the difficult. That's who teaches us patience. So without the so-called enemy, there'd be no patience, right? You got to have it. You got to have difficult, trying situations of people to develop inner strength and patience. We need that. Without patience, there's no bodhisattvas because there's a perfection of patience, which is one of the practices of a bodhisattva. Without bodhisattvas, there's no enlightenment. So who's the key to enlightenment? The enemy, the difficult person. That's our ticket out of samsara. We have to see difficult people is like our ticket out of samsara. We need to work with those projections, the negative ones, particularly as it revolves around our relationship with people. And then we look over here at the friend. Well, and also the enemy is the enemy hates our worst enemy, which is our self-cherishing attitude. Now, what about the friend? The friend is the friend of our self-cherishing attitude, right? They like us. They say nice things about us. Rarely will they tell us our flaws or our faults. You know, they say nice things to us. That's why we call them friends. But is the friend of our worst enemy, our self-cherishing, egocentric self, really our friend? You know, that's kind of bizarre reasoning, but it is. But they're not, you know, and they're changeable, and they're just like us. So you can use all kinds of reasonings that you can come up with to develop this equality, this equanimity that's going to be the foundation of every meditation you ever do on universal compassion has to start out with this. Because otherwise, if you don't feel equally toward friend, enemy, and stranger, you will not develop universal compassion. It's impossible. Take a break. So any questions about that? This is good. This is supposed to be juicy stuff, by the way, but if anybody has anything. I love this, by the way, but it is just, you know, I'm a little bit of a religious fanatic, so I can't help it. I think bodhicitta is the most important. In fact, I brought a book. I shouldn't really say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. This book, I got this book in 1980. I'm pretty sure it's the same one. I got this book from the Dalai Lama, and I met him at the Waldorf Astoria with Jeffrey Hopkins in 1980, and he gave me this book. I said, what's the most important book in Buddhism? And he gave me this book. Can you see it? It's The Bodhisattva's Way of Life by Shantideva. And he had a lot of them to hand out, so he was handing them out to everybody. But he said, this is the most profound, helpful book in all of Buddhism. So it's really talking about someone who's realized bodhicitta, this attitude that we're talking about, and not only just understands how to develop it, but actually has transformed their mind into bodhicitta. And then as part of the practice, as you're developing the attitude of bodhicitta, there are specific practices called the six perfections. And this book, the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, is talking about these six perfections. And they have to do with things like ethical self-discipline, okay, and patience, concentration, and wisdom, and joyful effort. And what am I missing? Ethics. And I jumped over to patience, concentration, wisdom.
Generosity.
There's another one. We just can't remember right now. Come on, Aaron.
What was that, Carmen?
The six perfections. Is,
generosity.
Talk about ethics.
Generosity.
What?
Generosity.
Generosity. Yes. Generosity. Sorry. So there's ethics, generosity, patience or tolerance. There's enthusiastic perseverance, concentration, and wisdom. Those are the six perfections that are outlined in this book. And so it sort of presupposes that you already have some feeling for the teachings on bodhicitta. So any comments or questions before we jump into this last part? What time is it? Oh my God.
Yeah, sorry everyone on online, we're talking about the time. It's already 8:00. I think Don would like to go a little longer, but if you do need to duck out, feel free.
Yeah.
And the class is posted to be an hour long. But if you want to stay, feel free to stay.
Yeah, I'm just going to touch on the 11 points. We won't spend more than like a minute on the, we've only got 10 more anyway. We'll just touch on the points to develop bodhicitta. So kind of sit up straight. And we've already at least got some sense of the importance of equanimity, this equality. I like to think of it as equal regard. You know, everybody wants to be happy. Nobody wants to suffer. They're just like me. In past lifetimes, they've been my mother. We've been in every conceivable relationship. And even in this lifetime, things are changeable. So we try to develop a feeling. Again, this is something that is, you know, when we talk about a realization, it's not these words. Equanimity. It's actually a feeling that goes along with the words that if it could speak would have this attitude of equal regard for all beings. That's the what we're shooting for, is to develop that realization in our mind. Equanimity. And the next point, which is the most, remember I said it's the hardest meditation of all to do in these 11 steps. The next one has to do with seeing all sentient beings as having been your mother. All right. Now, this presupposes that you have a little bit of faith in rebirth. And again, I've asked people, because I didn't believe in rebirth 100% when I'm still working with it, you know, many, many years later, I still have my doubts about it, but I have creatively aligned with it, is that is how it is. And that's what I ask you, is just to creatively align with it, particularly as we do these meditations on seeing all beings as mother. So now you look at your mother of this life, bring her to mind. She may or may not be alive now, but she's been your mother in countless previous lifetimes. And my mother's deceased now, but she will be my mother again in future lifetimes. And so there's not one living being that you can point to and say, that person definitely has not been my mother. And from the Buddhist perspective, we're trying to develop a sense of warmth and connection with all beings. And so, from the point of view of karma, in every lifetime, we've had to have a mother. And so it's conceivable, although almost inconceivable, that in every lifetime, we've had a relationship with everybody. All universal living beings, who are countless, have all been my mother countless times. That's the kind of attitude we need to have. So everybody's been my mother. My mother of this life has been my mother countless times, will be my mother again. All living beings have been my mother countless times and will be my mother again. So we want to see all beings as having been family, mother, could be father, could be, you know, whoever raised you and who you feel the closest to would be the person you would plug in here as mother. And you imagine yourself surrounded by universal living beings, all in human form, and you think they've all been mother. They've all been, having had that very intimate connection. That particular relationship is chosen because, generally speaking, it's the most profound one we'll ever have in our lives. So that relationship is chosen as the one to work with, but it could be others. And the next meditation is remembering the kindness of mother or others. And we can think of our mother of this life, you know, obviously 9 months, maybe the first 3 months, she was like throwing up all the time. And I can promise you the last 3 months, she couldn't get comfortable because she had about carrying 30 extra pounds, heartburn, couldn't get comfortable. When, you know, maybe she got sick during the last part of the pregnancy. You know, she could have died. A lot of women have died in childbirth. All kinds of things have happened. But no, she pushed through it. No pun intended. She pushed through it. She pushed you out, most likely. And you were born. And then she raised you. She fed you from her breast. And she changed your poopy diapers and all that mess. Got up in the middle of the night, took care of you when you were sick. When she was sick and you were crying, she would do anything. She'd get up and take care of you. She did whatever she needed to do. Right on to taking you to the first grade, and she cried her eyes out. Oh, my baby's going to the first grade. She's growing up, or he's growing up, to high school, to college, to beyond. And even to this day, if you go to prisons, by the way, maximum security prisons where they're all these heavy-duty criminals, and you ask their mother if they did anything wrong, most of their mothers will say, my baby would never do anything like that. Mothers are incredible that way. They just can only see the good in their children sometimes. I mean, so that's the point, is that we must remember the kindness of our mother in this life, and then we can extrapolate that feeling of oh, that's, you know, and if you do this right, you really do feel such a sense of appreciation and love for your mom of this life. Then you extrapolate that out to universal living beings that are all around you and think, they've all been as kind to me as my mom in this life. Even when we were animals, you know, she gave up her life for me, or he gave up his life for me, like that. And even if we weren't thinking about past and future lifetimes, even if we're just thinking about this room or our lives, where did this body come from? It came from others. This table came from others. The water came from others. Everything that we eat, everything that we have, that we enjoy, is due to others' kindness. Even if they didn't intend to be kind, we benefited from them. And so we owe others an incredible debt. You know, we owe them, we have, you know, a debt of kindness. We need to repay their kindness. So again, equanimity, seeing all beings as mother, remembering their kindness, and wishing to repay their kindness. Those are the first four steps. Then quickly we'll go through the next ones. The next one sounds very similar to the way we develop equanimity, but it's called equality of self and others. And the way the Dalai Lama does it is he sees himself, he imagines like a line, and on one side is Tenzin Gyatso, the Dalai Lama. And on the other side is, we'll just say 15 people, but it's actually universal living beings. We can imagine all in human form. We call those others. Now, I am one. Others are how many? Countless. At least 15, if we're going to use 15. But they're countless. So whose happiness is more important to work for? The happiness of one or the happiness of countless others? It looks like others are going to win. It looks like others' happiness is actually more important, at least as important as my happiness, right? So this is a big part of this particular meditation, is to begin to see that others' happiness is actually more important than ours, because they're countless. They're infinite beings. But at least if we can get to the point where we can see that their happiness is at least as important as my happiness, that's a good start. Then the next meditation, again, contemplation. You can kind of close your eyes or semi-close your eyes. But remember, we talked about the self-cherishing, the cause of all suffering from the beginning of beginningless time till now is one demonic force. It's ego, egocentricity, selfishness, this selfish, self-cherishing attitude. And the thing that Buddha realized under the Bodhi tree is that this sense of self is illusory. He saw that there was no true, inherently existent self that existed independent of the body and mind. It was just a projection of ignorance. And when he saw that, he was completely free. He was completely free. You know, he had all the qualities of the Buddha. When he developed this wisdom of emptiness, he was completely free. So we can see that self-cherishing causes all suffering, and the cause of it is egocentricity, which is a big mistake and is something that we need to identify as a problem and then work with it to eliminate it. The cause of all happiness is cherishing others, the exact opposite. If Lama Zopa said, for happiness, cherish others, just a smile, a kind word, any kind of gesture of kindness, you know, can change somebody's attitude from something negative into something positive. So cherishing others is the cause of all the positive karma that brings us happiness. If you cherish others, you wouldn't kill, would you? No, you wouldn't kill others if you really cherished them. You wouldn't steal from others. You wouldn't commit adultery. You wouldn't lie. You wouldn't slander, badmouth people, or speak harshly and in a disharmonious way, or waste people's time with idle gossip or greed, hatred, and ignorance. All those come out of self-cherishing selfishness. So we understand that self-cherishing is the problem. Cherishing others is the solution to the problem. the cause of happiness. I know I'm going fast, but I'm mixing my words up a little bit, but you get the point. The next one is exchanging self-cherishing for cherishing others, which is not I become you, but it's I let go of my, I'm exchanging the attitude of cherishing me as the most important one, and I'm replacing it with the attitude of cherishing you. So that, so that when I'm with you, I'm cherishing you. When I'm with others, I'm cherishing others. My attitude is others. Whatever I do for others. And we talk about it. Some things like, you know, you take care of your body. You take care of your health. You go to work for others. You take care of, you pay your bills because you want other businesses to work, but you want your family to thrive. Everything we do, we try to motivate it. We want the motivation of every action of body, speech, and mind to be other-oriented. Remember, actions motivated by non-attachment to oneself, non-hatred, non-ignorance, always lead to happiness. So cherishing others, having the attitude of cherishing others, you know, is not only the antidote to self-cherishing selfishness, but it's also the, that attitude will give us the happiness that we've always wanted. Then there's the practice of Tonglin, which we're going to spend a lot more time with in the coming weeks. But it's basically, we imagine, you know, great love and great compassion. So great love is the wish that others could be have happiness and its causes. And we have to feel that. Now, at this point, we should be able to feel that, not just say those words. Because honestly, I wish that you could have happiness and the cause of happiness. That is not love. Those are just words. They mean something, but that is not the experience of love. We all know what the experience of love is, and that's what we're going for. That heartfelt, in your heart of hearts, feeling that if it could speak, would say, may you be happy and have the causes of happiness. And remember we talked about, for us to have compassion, we have to feel close to people. So it's important to develop love. And then when we see that everybody's suffering, everybody's going through all of these sufferings of, you know, pain, the suffering of change, pervasive suffering, all those things that we talked about that everybody has to go through. Everybody has those problems, not just me, not just you. We all have them. And so we wish, may you be free. And we're talking about universal beings now. May you be free of suffering and its causes. May be free of suffering and its causes. Now, in this particular practice, it's really good. It's really, really important. And Jeffrey said this in his in this book that I'm reading called Cultivating Compassion. He said, it's so important to work with real people, work with your family, work with your spouse, work with your parents, your children, your coworkers, the people that you come into contact with, you have work with real people and then expand it out into more sort of generalized groups of people like all living beings or everybody in the hell realm, everybody in the hungry ghost realm, everybody in the animal realm. You can work with different groups of people like that or beings, but it doesn't touch your heart like it will if you're working with real people. Then the next, but it, so again, Tonglin is about giving happiness. And we practice, we harness that on the out-breath, and we imagine that beings have happiness in its causes, and then we inhale, and we bring in their suffering in the form of black smoke, and it destroys our self-cherishing attitudes of the heart. And so Tonglin is giving and taking, giving and taking, just continuously doing that. But you have to have feeling for these words. You cannot, you have to have feeling for the person that you're practicing Tonglin with. If you hate that person, you will not develop compassion for them. You know, you will be something different. So definitely have to work with real people. And we don't go with the enemy. Work with easy people first, and then hopefully we can graduate to the more difficult people. And then finally, the supreme wish, which is I take, it's my personal responsibility to alleviate the suffering of all beings and establish them in supreme enlightenment. Nobody else's job is mine. It's not somebody else's job. They helped me, and I take, this is the Bodhisattva's vow, basically, is I am responsible for the happiness of all beings, and I'm going to develop, you know, and I'm going to free them from suffering. I don't care where they are in samsara. It could be the hell realms, hungry ghost, animal, human, you know, jealous gods, you know, the God realm, whatever realm they're in, whatever life they're living in this life, you know, we're going to free them from suffering and establish them. We're going to help them plant the seeds for supreme enlightenment. But then we go, uh-oh, wait a minute. I haven't even done it for myself. I haven't done it for me. How can I do it for other beings? And so we realize that our goal, we want to play the biggest game. And if you're going to set a goal, you want to set a goal that's like beyond your wildest dreams. You don't want to set some goal that's easy. Like, I'm going to drink this glass of water. That's not a real goal. Something like, I want to become enlightened. That's a real goal. That's a game worth playing. So set your goal for supreme enlightenment in order to liberate sentient beings based on love and compassion, based on sincere love and compassion. And then the realization that we don't have it together yet. We have to cultivate within our own mind stream the path. We have to develop renunciation. We have to develop bodhicitta and correct view of emptiness. And then we also have to practice tantra. We have to practice generation and completion stage of tantra, because that's how you get fully enlightened, is through the practice of tantra. And so the whole path has been laid out for us. It's like this unbroken lineage from the time of the Buddha up until right now. It's been laid out. And all we have to do is plug in. We just have to plug our consciousness in and do the work. Do the work to develop these different understandings, these different realizations. But bodhicitta is the heart of the Mahayana. It is the heart of the Mahayana, and it is the reason why it's really possible to develop a direct intuitive insight into emptiness, because you can develop so much positive merit in such a short time when you're motivated by bodhicitta. If you're motivated by just yourself, I'm going to practice because I want to be happy and I don't want to suffer and I just want to have a good day today. And there's nothing wrong with that. Trust me. That, you know, there's a whole school of Buddhism, and that's their motivation. The Theravada wish is that I want to achieve nirvana. I want to achieve perfect freedom from suffering. Now, they definitely in Thailand, because I lived in Thailand and Sri Lanka for quite a while, and they do have compassion and they do have love, but it's not aimed at universal living beings. It's aimed at the individual. But here we realize we have to practice renunciation, bodhicitta, correct view of emptiness. We have to develop, you know, and bodhicitta is the heart of it. It's the heart of it. So this week I would like for you to meditate on bodhicitta and then touch on these other 10 points. You can just read through them if you want to. If you have time, if you've read through Rupa Rinpoche's book on how to develop bodhicitta, then there's some definite points that can help you in your meditation. But the key one this next week is equanimity. And I might focus on that for a couple of weeks, because to me, that is so helpful. Because you can bring to mind people that you're attached to and you have an unhealthy relationship with because of that attachment. And you can learn not to become detached, but to let go of, to not attach. That's the opposite of attachment. It's non-attachment. Okay. So we have equal regard for these people. And the same thing way with the enemy. I've used this so many times that people I have problems with. I bring to mind these people that, you know, whoever they are, and I see that they want to be happy like I want to be. That's a changeable relationship. And they're the cause of me developing patience. and their actions are just my own form of karmic actions coming back to me. I'm not a victim. I'm not a victim. This is my own karmic seeds ripening in the form of they harming me. If somebody hit me with a stick, I wouldn't be getting mad at the stick. I'd get mad at the person wielding the stick. In the same way, they're like the stick. The person wielding the stick is my own past former actions, the negative actions that created the karma for me to be harmed by somebody else. You understand that analogy? That the cause of my suffering is my own former actions, and the perpetrator is like the stick. The real cause of the suffering is my mind and the seeds planted on there in the past. Could have been a past lifetime, could have been this lifetime. But that's the key. The equanimity. So let's work on that this week and on the other points that we just touched on right up until you develop bodhicitta. Okay? Any quick questions before we shut down for tonight? God, everybody's got this. This is so cool. We got it.
Don, I missed last week.
Yeah.
Where are the 11 points written about? I wasn't at the first class.
I can answer that, Bob. It's on the, or do you have access to the course materials online? It's posted there. Yeah, and I'll include them in tonight's homework as well when I post that.
Yeah, I'm actually going to put some homework up this time. I lost my mind last week. It got crazy. But yeah, we'll post some homework and some questions and things like that for you to do this week. And by the way, you know, Geshe-la talked yesterday, Sunday, yeah, about mindfulness and stuff like that. And I think, you know, I talked about mindfulness earlier, and from the Buddhist perspective, mindfulness, you know, does mean being present, being alert, aware in the moment. All those things are true, but it's also about being mindful of the teachings. It's about being mindful of emptiness. It's about being mindful of impermanence and mindful of compassion and love. It's recollecting those things and bringing those awareness, that awareness into the moment as well. It's not only noticing when your mind is going off on a tangent or you're getting ready to erupt in anger. It's good to be mindful of that. But then to be mindful of the Dharma is really what the mindfulness is about. And it's much more profound because bank robbers have mindfulness, right? Murderers have mindfulness. But mindfulness has a kind of, from a Buddhist perspective, it really is about the practice of virtue, that mindfulness enhances the practice of virtue, allows us to develop positive mind states and to eliminate those that are negative and destructive. So let's do our dedication. Any questions again? This is a pretty bold group. But next time I'm going to start calling on people, so get ready. You better do your homework. Okay, so we'll do the Shanti Deva's dedication. Now, what you need to think about when you're dedicating is we have planted like a lot of seeds tonight, right? We're going to say, I don't know, bazillions of karmic seeds because, you know, in every finger snap, there's like 60 mind moments. There's been a lot of mind moments in the last hour and some. So we have no idea how many karmic seeds. If your motivation has been positive and virtuous, those are going to be good karmic seeds, guaranteed to ripen as happens, okay? And so what we want to do is imagine that all of these seeds are going out to universal living beings and going to ripen in supreme happiness and bodhicitta, okay? So we'll do this together. May all beings everywhere, plagued by suffering of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merit. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be free from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may these never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and may those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So we imagine that we've shared all this positive karmic seeds. We shared them with universal living beings. And so it multiplies that karma. If it was just for us, it would be like one seed. But it now has countless seeds because it was dedicated to countless beings. So it's so much more powerful. Any action motivated by bodhicitta becomes the cause for enlightenment. So much more powerful than an action motivated by selfish self-cherishing. So we need to remember that. Okay, so thank you for your presence and look forward to next week. We'll have some homework for you to do. I recommend doing shorter meditations rather than long ones because it's easy to go kind of brain dead when you do long ones. I think it's better to do multiple short ones. And next week we might experiment with that. Maybe do 2 minutes here, 3 minutes there, different points along here as we touch on these different points in the meditation. By the way, this book, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, cannot go wrong.